From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of the stars of 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about a family that runs a funeral home. Michael C. Hall plays David Fisher, the brother who is straight-laced, business-oriented, and gay. Also, independent filmmaker Hal Hartley talks about his new movie, No Such Thing. It's somewhat of a departure from his earlier films, such as Henry Fool, Trust, and The Unbelievable Truth. No Such Thing is about a monster who is cursed with eternal life. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews 2 new Fox comedy shows, Andy Richter Controls the Universe, and Greg the Bunny. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Citing Israeli conditions that he termed unacceptable, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has decided not to attend the Arab summit that opens tomorrow in Beirut. The news came amid further violence in the West Bank. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told Israeli TV that before his government would allow Arafat to travel to Beirut, it wanted recognition that Israel has the right to block him from returning if Palestinian attacks occurred during his absence. Palestinian Information Minister Yasser Abed Rabo called the conditions provocative and humiliating and said Arafat would not attend the summit, which will focus on a Saudi peace proposal for the Mideast. Arafat may still get to address the delegates by way of a video conference hookup. In the West Bank, 2 members of a European observer group on their way back to Hebron were shot and killed on a road frequented by settlers. The army said Palestinian gunmen opened fire, but Palestinian officials blamed Israeli troops. The observers were unarmed and were traveling in a marked car. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The chief of the Arthur Andersen accounting firm stepped down today as the company faces a criminal indictment for its role in the Enron collapse. Joseph Berardino announced his retirement as Andersen's CEO this evening on CNN. Last week, former Federal Reserve Chief Paul Volcker recommended the resignation of Andersen's top management as part of an independent plan to save the troubled company. Volcker's hoping that the creation of an independent board will persuade the Justice Department to dismiss an indictment that accuses Andersen of obstruction of justice in the destruction of documents related to its audit of Enron. 4 African Americans filed a class action lawsuit in a Brooklyn federal court today, seeking reparations for slavery. Nancy Solomon reports from member station WBGO.
The lawsuit targets 3 American corporations and seeks an unspecified amount of money in restitution. The 4 plaintiffs hope to represent 35 million African Americans who are descendants of slaves. They allege Aetna Insurance sold policies to owners of slaves, that CSX used slaves to build its railroads, and that Fleet Boston was founded by a slave trader. Attorney Bruce Nagler says corporate America benefited from slavery and should now pay restitution.
We're looking to set up humanitarian funds to aid and begin to repair the institutions in the African American community that have been devastated through the horror of slavery.
Some legal experts are critical of the lawsuit, saying it is unlikely the courts could remedy something that happened so long ago. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon in New York.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 71 points to close at 10,353 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 11 points. It closed at 1,824. The S&P 500 gained 6. This is NPR News. At least 4 people were killed today in a head-on collision between a tour bus and a delivery truck in Wisconsin. The county sheriff's office said the crash took place in the town of Exonia. The chartered bus was carrying 21 people from a retirement home on a trip to Milwaukee, about 30 miles away. A sheriff's spokesman said there was no one who escaped the crash uninjured. Medical officials say more than a dozen people had to be hospitalized. China launched its 3rd unmanned spacecraft last night as the country continues to work toward putting an astronaut in space. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing.
China considers its decade-old manned space program as a major source of national pride. So President Jiang Zemin himself was on hand at the launch site in northwestern China to see the Shenzhou-3 take off aboard a Long March rocket. 10 minutes after takeoff, the craft separated from the rocket and moved into its preset orbit. The official China Daily newspaper quoted President Jiang saying the launch showed the Chinese people's spirit of constantly striving to become stronger. Beijing aims to put astronauts in space within the next 5 to 10 years. The Shenzhou-2, launched last year, contained a monkey, a dog and a rabbit. The Shenzhou-3 carried dummy astronauts on board and is equipped to sustain human life. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
Emergency officials say an earthquake has killed at least 1,800 people in northern Afghanistan. The Afghan interior minister said the quake and its aftershocks injured more than 3,000 people in the mountainous Baghlan region. The local military commander said the quake flattened about 20,000 mud brick houses. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the James Irvine Foundation, supporting NPR's West Coast expansion, www.irvine.org, partners in building a better California.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael C. Hall, is one of the stars of 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about a family that owns a funeral business. The father who ran the business died in the first episode. The two sons have taken over. One son, Nate, became a partner very reluctantly. The other, David, played by Michael Hall, had already been active in the business. David is more straight-laced, business-oriented, and uptight than his brother. He's also gay, which until recently he'd kept a secret from everyone, including his family. In the first episode of this season, his mother was trying to be supportive of his sexual orientation. At the same time, she wanted to let her children know that she's having a relationship with Nikolai, the owner of the flower shop where she works. In this scene, she's telling the family that she's invited Nikolai to a family dinner. She wants each of her children to bring someone, too.
Nate, I'd like you to invite Brenda. Claire, I'd like you to invite Gabriel Dimas. And David, if you have a special friend, I'd like for him to come as well.
Why is my friend special?
All right. If you're having sex with anyone, I'd like to meet him. Is that better?
Not really.
Stop acting like children! Are you seeing anyone?
No.
Well, why not? Sex is an important and healthy part of life. It's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yes, I know that. Unfortunately, I'm not having any right now.
What happened to that cop? The black man?
He met someone else.
Michael C. Hall has developed quite a following, but most of his fans know little about him since his previous work was in theater. In the Broadway revival of Cabaret, he played the MC after Alan Cumming left the role. In the revival, the MC is very sexually insinuating. I told Hall it was hard for me to imagine him in that role after seeing him portray someone so inhibited in 6 Feet Under.
I guess I sort of was required to close every door that I'd opened while doing the MC when I came to play David. And the roadmap was there. I'm obviously different from Alan, and it's the MC is a role that you're certainly, as much as any role, required to personalize. But I definitely was someone who was maybe a pansexual, up for anything. And when I did the pilot, I went back to New York to do the production of Cabaret for another month before we came and did the 12 other episodes for the season. And I would sometimes take a break on stage and realize that I was maybe playing David's fantasy of himself in a way. And it was really interesting to go from such an extreme to someone who was so shut down in so many ways.
When you auditioned, did you know which brother you were auditioning for?
Yeah. I was asked to read for the part of David from the beginning. And when I read the script, I think I responded to that role. Because, of course, I had it in mind, but I think I would have anyway, just because, you know, if drama is conflict, David is inherently dramatic because he's conflicted over his sexuality, of course, but also his relationship to his family, to his work, to his religious life even. They're all characterized by conflict.
So what did you have to do to prove yourself against the other David Fishers?
I don't know. I think in spite of the fact that on paper, I suppose I'm very different from David, there was something that I did immediately respond to in terms of having a sense of how he might express himself or how he walked or breathed or, I don't know, that sense of resenting what you imagine to be a lack of appreciation for all the sacrifices you've made for all the other people in your life. And not that I am fueled by resentment, but I guess I knew what that was about somehow and took that as a starting point.
In 6 Feet Under, you play someone who runs a family funeral business. Had you already had the experience of going to a funeral director and organizing a funeral, choosing the coffin, making all those horrible arrangements?
I'd been sort of on the periphery of intake meetings. I was never the person who was making the decisions, but I'd been through that with family members and the like, and I'd been to wakes of friends and family members, and could draw on that just that atmosphere. I've heard Alan talk about it. Just it's a place where, and I think they do this in terms of the way they shoot the show, that everything's real, but there's just some sort of peppering of surreality when you're in that situation. Of course, David and Nate are on the other side of that and maybe are creating a space for people to exist in a place where they can feel whatever they need to feel, but there remains that element of surreality or timelessness. Time stops, and I remembered that.
Did you meet anybody who reminded you of yourself on the other end of the desk when you were arranging the funerals?
Well, I think my father passed away when I was 11, and I think my most intense memories of spending time in a funeral home were come from that time. And I guess we haven't had someone quite that young, but I know when Gabe Demas, whose younger 6-year-old brother shot and killed himself accidentally, was there with his mother. Of course, he felt an incredible amount of guilt and responsibility because he was looking after a kid who shot himself. But when my father died, just because of the confusing feelings that come up, I dealt with some of that sense of guilt or vague responsibility as well. So I think I did relate to that, yeah.
Well, so far this season, the good news is you don't have AIDS, although you'd been having unprotected sex. The bad news is you do have gonorrhea.
Right.
The other bad news is your ex-boyfriend appears to be in a solid relationship with a new
yes.
guy, and you still have feelings for him.
Right.
When did you find out what the story for this season would be?
Well, we really find out about things on a script-to-script or episode-to-episode basis, so I wasn't presented with an arc for the new season. I was presented with the first script, and while shooting that script, about halfway through, would get a copy of the next, and so on and so on. So it's kind of like leading a second life. You have a little bit of warning, and sometimes you'll maybe want to get a sense of where things are going just so you can have that in mind. But I think one of the unique challenges of doing an episodic serial like this is that you don't rehearse it as an entire piece as you would a play, or don't shoot it with an entire arc in mind. At least when you do a movie, you have something that's very open-ended, and every script is a page turner. You know, we never know exactly what's going to come next, but that's the fun of it too.
What do people most ask you about in terms of the plot? What do people most want to know?
Early on, people were interested in who burned down the house.
Right.
But I guess usually specific questions about the show have to do with my character, because of course they're talking to me. And I've had a woman recognize me and tell me she loves the show, and then put her hand on my arm and tell me that she hopes that I'm going to be okay. This was about halfway through the first season, which was kind of exciting and creepy simultaneously. There was a guy who walked by me in the locker room of the gym in New York, an older guy, and this was after the season finale when David had had his epiphany in church, and he told me he was glad I was finally starting to behave myself. That's all he said. just said that and walked away. And, you know, like a New York fireman walked up and recognized me from the show and said, "Are you going to get back together with that cop? I like you guys," you know, so, which is great.
I do too. I also think you should get back together.
Good.
Here comes a question that you might not want to answer. So,
okay.
I'll just remind you, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to.
Right.
Because you play a gay character,
right?
Probably a lot of viewers wonder if you are gay or straight yourself, and how you feel about playing a gay character in the series.
Right. Well, you know, my first impulse is to say, well, what does it matter? But I think the fact that the character has resonance is why it matters. People inevitably have varying degrees of preoccupation with sexual orientation. I'm not gay. No one ever asked me if I'm a mortician, you know. But
we know you're not. We know
right,
you're
I'm
an actor.
Right. I'm not gay. I'm not a mortician. I'm an only child, not a middle child. So I'm, you know, it's a bit of internal alchemy and imaginative work that is why I do what I do. And I'm really honored to breathe life into the character because I recognize, as I think a lot of people do, that he's a pretty unique creation in terms of a character on television or film or really anywhere I've seen, and that he's a complex flesh and blood, you know, person who's not incidentally gay and is not the understanding neighbor upstairs or the comic relief. His relationship to his sexuality is very complicated, and I think that's unique. So I feel a sense of responsibility, and I'm honored to play the part.
Is it an issue anymore playing a gay character, and how that may or may not affect future casting roles? Is that
I don't know.
Is that just
I mean,
a thing of the past now, or is that something?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I think it's certainly not enough of an issue for me to not play the part. And when I read the part, I'm not playing David in spite of the fact that he's gay. I mean, because he's such a great character because of his conflict, and his conflict is rooted in his relationship to his sexuality. So I guess in that sense, I'm playing the part because he's gay. But I don't know, you know, if anybody out there lacks the imagination or is holding on to whatever bigotry that would keep them from wanting to work with me, I don't really want to work with them anyway, so.
My guest is Michael C. Hall. He plays David on the HBO series 6 Feet Under. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Michael C. Hall, plays David, the gay brother on 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about a family that runs a funeral home. Have you been in movies?
Nope.
None at all? Not even a small part?
No, this is really my first thing, other than I did a couple days. I delivered some room service on an episode of All My Children in between theater jobs back in New York. But other than that, this is it. This is, I mean, they definitely took a chance because I didn't have a reel or anything when they hired me of screen work. So this is my first chance to get in front of a camera. I'm just glad that I was able to play a character who was so tense because I didn't have to try to get over it. I could just incorporate it into what I was doing and hope that as David relaxed, I as an actor would relax as well.
Do you have a favorite episode from the series so far?
Favorite
scene for yourself?
I guess some of my favorite scenes and one of my favorite episodes are in there's the Las Vegas episode, I guess the third to last episode of the first season. I think because in that episode, David's coming out to his mother and his epiphany at the church, and the final episode notwithstanding, it's one of his biggest triumphs in that he goes to Las Vegas, steps in, and gives a speech that his father was scheduled to give, and goes off the cue cards, throws them in the air, and improvises, which is something that he's not so inclined to do, and it's a triumph, and his dad's former colleagues embrace him and take him out, and then he's outed by a stripper. They turn on him, and David in turn turns on himself and acts out in the most extremely self-loathing way that he does up to that point when he solicits the prostitute in Las Vegas. So as far as David goes from the top of the mountain all the way to the bottom in that episode, and that was fun.
What did you do to prepare for it?
With a job like this, I guess I could say that was the 11th episode. So in a way, I did the first 10 episodes.
I'd played, good answer.
I'd played David for 10 hours, and I found myself very, preparing, and I was very on top of things early on, and I had a real sense of how it would all unfold, and of course would modify that as we actually shot the scenes. Towards the end, you really do have to surrender somewhat. You can't do that kind of preparation again and again and again, because in a lot of ways all the work you've done up to that point is that preparation.
Now, you said you'd never done any movies, and Right. Really not any television either.
Right.
Before doing 6 Feet Under. But you had done stage work.
Mm-hmm.
The transition from stage to camera can be difficult. What was the transition like for you? Because you had to learn what it's like to be in front of the camera, and you had to learn for real really quickly.
Yeah. I think I've done my share of auditioning before getting this job for television shows or small parts in movies, and I think having a character that I could so completely absorb myself with helped me to forget about the camera initially. And whereas sometimes reading for a sitcom pilot, my self-consciousness would be a larger presence than my sense of the character. And as I've gone on, I think I've realized that the camera can be your friend, and you have to sort of accept that it's very much in the room with you, and in a lot of ways a character in the scene because it's the point of view.
How aware are you of where the camera is, what it's looking at?
It varies. 6 Feet Under, we do a lot of different kinds of shots. There's a standard shot that you may notice that there'll be someone in the foreground and someone in the background. They'll do raking shots sometimes, two characters in profile, but they're both in focus. Sometimes during intake meetings, maybe you'll see David and Nate, one you're almost close enough to whisper into one character's ear, and then the other one's a little bit beyond that. And when a camera's that close to you, you definitely need to keep in mind that it's there and maybe modify modify what you're doing or the degree to which you're doing it. And rather than pretending the camera isn't there, very much embracing the camera and where it is. And I people always talked about making love to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
I never really had a sense of what that meant until I think it's about that. It's about not shutting it out, but rather opening yourself to it. And I think Frances Conroy, who plays the mother on the show, is an amazing example of that. She's just so sort of wide open in terms of her screen presence.
Are there things that really surprised you about how you looked on camera?
I thought I looked like an alien.
I
wasn't used to it. It's kind of like the first time you hear your tape-recorded voice, maybe.
Uh-huh.
I watched the pilot, and I thought everyone was wonderful, but there was this alien in a suit walking through the scenes. But at the same time, I tried to get over that because I know some actors say they don't watch themselves, but I feel like there's a great deal to learn in that. And I've gotten a little bit more used to it. Inevitably, I cringe at some points, and sometimes that's about acting, sometimes it's about vanity, but...
Well, those two things can really be in conflict. If you're self-conscious, but you feel that the way to learn is to watch yourself, you know, those two impulses are a little bit at war.
Yeah, it's interesting because the look of the show is we have different directors for almost every episode, but because the look of the show is somewhat consistent, now when we shoot shots, at least on a set that's familiar to me, I really, when I watch them afterwards, I realize that I can totally see them in my head, and so that's nice.
Now, earlier we were talking about how before you got the role of David Fisher on 6 Feet Under, you played the MC in the Broadway production of Cabaret. Have you done much singing and dancing on stage?
When I was a kid, my first experiences performing were in choirs. I was in a boys' choir, like in fifth grade, and did a lot of choral singing through college. I was in a chamber choir that sang in Vienna, and I did a lot of that, and did high school musicals. But when I got out of college, I went to grad school at NYU and really focused strictly on acting. And I guess it wasn't until a few years out of college that I started to do some workshops of musical theater pieces in New York and came back to the musical theater. But I think I always knew that I probably would.
What were your biggest parts in musicals when you were in school?
I went to a private day school, and so there was a big musical that I was a part of every spring from sixth grade through my senior year. So I did, see if I can remember them, The Sound of Music, The King and I, South Pacific, Bye Bye Birdie, Oklahoma, Fiddler on the Roof, and Annie Get Your Gun.
So what were the songs that were best suited to you?
Best suited to me?
Mm-hmm.
I would say my favorite performance, and it was ultimately just a chance to show off, was in ninth grade when I got to play Conrad Birdie in Bye Bye Birdie. And got to walk into the audience and spray painted my hair black. And
did you get to sing Sincere?
Got to be, yeah. You got to be sincere, and what a lot of living to do.
Oh,
which ironically enough, I sang the Anne Margaret verse of in the 10th episode of 6 Feet Under in the first season when I was dancing with the vacuum cleaner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael C. Hall plays David on the HBO series 6 Feet Under. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Well, we don't have Anne Margaret handy, but here's music from the original cast recording of Bye Bye Birdie.
There are chicks just right for some kissing, and I mean to kiss me a few. Man, those chicks don't know what they're missing.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By Audi. In performance, technology, and design, the goal remains constant. Never follow. Information available at AudiUSA.com. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House. Publisher of Love, Greg and Lauren, a husband's day-by-day account of his wife's remarkable recovery. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, independent filmmaker Hal Hartley talks about his new film, No Such Thing. It's his version of a monster movie. His other films include Henry Fool, Trust, and The Unbelievable Truth. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new Fox comedies, Andy Richter Controls the Universe, and Greg the Bunny.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hal Hartley, is an independent film director and screenwriter. His movies include Trust, The Unbelievable Truth, Amateur, and Henry Fool. He's described his ongoing theme as societies, families, and groups of individuals and their relationship to what they consider the worst in them. His new movie is his version of a monster movie. It's called No Such Thing, as in the expression, there's no such thing as monsters. The monster is a very human-looking entity that lives in Iceland. The other main character is a young woman, played by Sarah Polley, who works in New York at a tabloid TV news magazine. Her boyfriend was with a crew from the show that went searching for the monster and is believed to have been killed by the monster. She soon sets off for Iceland to find out what happened. From the opening of the film, here's the monster speaking.
I'm not the monster I used to be. I admit that. I'm tired. I'm weaker. I'm losing my memory. And I can't sleep. Still, these friends of yours, well, they're dead now. I tore all three of them to pieces and tossed the whole mess off the cliffs out back. Let the vultures fight over what's left. This is ridiculous. I try to withdraw. I retire. I hide. But still you find me out. Even in my dreams. Polluting my solitude. Filling the air itself with your unending and pointless noise. Go ahead, kill me! Try it!
I asked Hal Hartley about creating a contemporary monster.
Of course, monsters, you always have to find out first what is their Achilles heel. What can kill them? And I started to work from there. And then I thought, information, this is what everybody calls the information age. And I thought, all right, so maybe I'll dream up a monster from that perspective. First find out what his Achilles heel is and then work backwards to shape him. Later in the film, it's even brought up that perhaps the monster doesn't even exist, that humanity brought him into existence by sheer will of imagination. But his Achilles heel is that he doesn't know why he exists, and he can't die. But he can endure untold amounts of pain.
The monster doesn't exactly look like a monster per se. He looks like a human, but a human who hasn't kind of bathed or shaved in a very long time and is wearing a kind of like filthy blanket type of thing and has horns, but still he looks pretty human. His opposite in this is a very, beautiful, very kind of seemingly innocent and maybe naive young woman played by Sarah Polley. Do you see a connection between your story and Beauty and the Beast?
Not directly. I looked at every monster movie, when I began and said, what could I use? And the first one I looked at was Beauty and the Beast. I thought, well, given what I'm thinking about, perhaps this is the best place to start. But I found very little that I wanted to bring from that. I actually found more material to kind of converse with in the Japanese monster movies like Godzilla and Mothra. The fact that, yes, there's a beautiful young girl and this monster, and they kind of, they are attracted to each other for different reasons, but it's not a romance, I think.
Your movie, No Such Thing, is set in part in Iceland and part in New York. In the opening New York chapter, the young woman played by Sarah Polley wants to get out of New York and find this alleged monster in Iceland, but she is in a plane crash on the way. She's the only survivor. She's found in the ocean, and she manages to survive, but she has great damage done to her body. And in order to restore her body, she has to have this very painful operation. And it sounds like an operation that you invented. I've never heard of such an operation. Is this something that you dreamed up for the movie?
Absolutely.
Why don't you describe it? It's quite awful.
The idea was that eventually this young woman would meet the monster. I knew that. And I wanted the monster to be impressed with her in a way that he's not impressed with other members of the human race. That in some way he recognizes that she's unusually strong on a number of different planes, certainly emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, she's strong. But I wanted her also to have physically gone through something very intense. So basically, she's the only survivor of this plane crash, and they drag her out of the ocean, the North Sea, and she's, obviously a frostbite, and like every bone in her body's been banged up, and her spine is in pieces. And so the idea was that they put the girl in this rig, and they are going to put her spine back together again, but there comes a point when they can never let her sleep during this. They can anesthetize her in stages, but the anesthesia has to be diminished in stages so that as they get to the end of the very long operation, when the critical work is being done, she has no anesthesia at all. And this is when they're actually sticking needles and stuff in her spine, in her spinal cord. So it's about as painful as anything you could imagine, and you have to endure it.
What did you dream up such a horror?
Well, I was actually trying to imagine just the most painful thing that a person could go through. Two things informed it. One, when I was a kid, I had a friend who had a spinal tap, and I didn't know what that was. He didn't know what it was. And it took him like 3-4 years, little by little, to describe it to me and my other friends, It was like he didn't, at 14, he didn't have the language to discuss with his best friends the nature of the pain that he had endured. It was almost like he was embarrassed. It was odd. We were, 18, 19 before, he finally, could talk about it. I had gotten attacked by a dog when I was about 24, I guess. One of these killer dogs that people like to have these days, attacked me, bit me right in the face, and had torn up my my mouth above and below. And I had to have plastic surgery immediately without anesthesia, because they needed me to be awake to work with them to stitch inside and outside my mouth, and down my chin and up the side of my face. And so that was like a 6-hour ordeal. And the Novocaine, whatever they could do, the local anesthesia would just pour right out, because there was no, the body wouldn't hold it. It would just wind up in my mouth.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah. And, I endured that. I never would have given myself a lot of credit for being, very stoic with pain. But people surprise themselves. They really do. So anyway, that was the idea. And those were the things I reached for.
So you took the inspiration from real life and then made up something based on it, but totally different from it.
Yeah, it needed to be larger and mysterious. And the difficult thing about writing that scene was sort of like saying enough to affect the audience, so that they can, in a sense, feel the pain, but not saying so much that you give it away. You have to sound authoritative, but basically be, blowing smoke rings.
And you're also not showing her being tortured. I mean, it's not a sadistic scene. You don't see very much.
Yeah, no, it's very, it's a kind of ceremony, that scene. Its pace, its steadiness. And we were thinking very much, Sarah and I, and the various designers, about The Bride of Frankenstein, that we felt like this was the scene where Sarah becomes the bride of the monster somehow, even before meeting him, you know, that they have to become equals on some level.
Because of what they've endured.
Yeah, pretty much pain is at the heart of it. I mean, he's enduring all of this pain. The more information there is in the world, the more radio waves, I guess, and things like that. Like one of the other doctors in later in the film says that he's sort of like a radar dish, and all this information, human-generated information, kind of gets directed at him. He picks it all up like he's an antenna. And it manifests itself in him as this incredibly intense pain, which is why, I guess, he's in such a bad mood and he drinks a lot and he curses
right.
a lot.
A real crabby monster.
Yeah.
Did you watch monster movies as a kid?
Not many. No, I was scared of monster movies. I didn't.
That's the reason why you watch them, though, because they're scary.
Yeah, well, not me. I think I was a much more sensible kid. I stayed away from what scared me. But I began getting very interested in them when I got older. And in fact, one of the first movies that I became very interested in and watched again and again and again was Nosferatu by Murnau, the original silent, you know, vampire movie. And we thought a lot about that film and Werner Herzog's remake of it from 1978. We thought a lot about it for a couple of reasons. One, that we wanted a monster who was sort of like not mechanical and not, basically we wanted a monster where the actor could just act, you know, they wouldn't be too burdened down with special effects and stuff. And so we said, yeah, all right, so he'll be a man, you know, like look at Nosferatu. It's really just a hand treatment and a face and head treatment.
My guest is independent director and screenwriter Hal Hartley. His new film is called No Such Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hal Hartley. He wrote and directed the new film No Such Thing. His first film, The Unbelievable Truth, was about two misfits, Josh, a convict getting out of prison who hitchhikes to Lindenhurst, Long Island, and ends up working for a garage, and Audrey, the garage owner's daughter, who's not cut out for a conventional life and is attracted to the convict. In this scene, she brings a book to the garage for him.
Life of George Washington. Father of our country.
Thanks. What's this one?
Misanthrope. Molière, it's a play.
What's a misanthrope?
Somebody who doesn't like people. I star in it. I mean, in class, we read it in class.
Are you the misanthrope?
No, I wanted to be, but they wouldn't let me play a man, so instead I play a flirt.
Is it an interesting role?
Being a flirt?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes, but the thing about flirting is that it leads to harder things.
Is that bad?
No, it isn't bad. It's just that it turns out pretty badly for the woman I play.
What happens?
She can't stop flirting.
Ever?
It's just the way some people are. She flirts herself to death.
Yeah. It's a sad play.
Well, she doesn't die, actually. It's just that the only man who really loves her has impossible standards.
Mm. That's too bad.
Yeah, it is.
Well, does it have a happy ending?
Nobody gets what they want. And they all go away frustrated and sad.
Tragedy.
The Unbelievable Truth was set in Lindenhurst, Long Island, where Hal Hartley grew up. I asked why he set his first film there.
Like everything else, it's practical and aesthetic. It was a very, very small budget film, and I had to shoot it very quickly, and I needed, you know, whatever support I could get. And luckily, my extended family, my cousins and my aunts and uncles were able to help me, you know, give me places for the crew to sleep, let me shoot in their houses, etc. And then aesthetically, it's just, I grew up there and, you know, my imagination formulated stories and images there, it was very easy for me to write a scene of a certain type and place it on this street corner or in this backyard or at that beach. That making my first film was this very quick opportunity that came up. I was pretty much just standing there, prepared to make another short 16mm film, and then this opportunity came up. Someone was going to put money up for me to make that same film in 35mm as a feature, and I had to think on my feet. I just said, okay, well, how? It's home, these places that I know, this subject matter, which is pretty much my basic preoccupation all the time now at the age of 28. Let's just do it. I think I just told people what the story was out loud before I had even written the script. Mm-hmm. Kind of sort of used talking, telling people what the story was to convince them that it was a legitimate situation. And that was sort of like how I came up with the story. It probably changed a little bit every single time I told it to a different person. And by the time I said it 3 or 4 times, I was like, okay, now I have something to write.
Dialogue is a very important part of your movies. And it's very colloquial, the dialogue you write. And yet it's not quite naturalistic, because a lot of your stories aren't quite naturalistic. They're often...
That is really an excellent way of saying that. It's colloquial and not naturalistic. That's, I'm going to use that.
Oh.
If somebody asks me what I try to do, I'm going to say, that's exactly it. Again, it's sort of a method that you don't dwell on that much as a writer. You don't, get up in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to write colloquial dialogue that's non-naturalistic. But in fact, that's a very good way of saying it.
Well, can you talk about why you write in that way and what your process of writing dialogue is?
Sure.
And when I say it's not quite naturalistic, I mean that's because your stories aren't quite naturalistic. I mean, they're kind of about real people, but real people who are extreme in one trait or another. The stories are often, in their own way, almost like parables, even though they're set, in the contemporary world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the colloquial part is certainly that I just love the music of language, and I like hearing different people talk, talk in different ways, their accents, their... And I love the misunderstanding of language, sort of how it works. Earlier in my career, anyway, I wrote a lot of scenes where people would be talking about two entirely different things to each other, but somehow they're communicating to each other, but they're actually saying all this other stuff, or they're talking at cross purposes, and just misunderstanding that they're understanding each other. I sort of like that kind of Rubik's Cube construction of language.
Your first film was in 1988. You've made independent films through your career. Are you ever frustrated that you're still making independent movies? Some people who started with independent movies have ended up, making big budget studio films.
In the sense that there's not as many people to talk to. I just do what I have to do. I work in a very particular way, and the way I work has been very successful for me. But it does make it harder when there's fewer people working the way, for instance, I work generally. It's harder to get the films made. Because you begin to be seen as an iconoclast when you have no intention to be that. 10 years ago, making films like Henry Fool or Simple Man or Trust or something was just, these are like these smaller films made by individuals, and that's exciting and interesting and a great alternative to movies that are made by corporations, which are designed to meet the expectations of the widest possible demographic. Now you're seen as some kind of oddity. And we didn't feel odd 10 years ago.
One last thing. I recently saw a movie, a documentary, about Iranian directors and the kind of censorship that they're up against in Iran. And one of the young women directors interviewed in the movie, when asked who her favorite filmmakers were, one of them was Hal Hartley. And I thought, gee, are his films getting into Iran?
Yeah, no, they are. And I'm very happy about that. I mean, this is a very, as I'm sure you probably have heard, I mean, there's a real great cultural, well, I guess it would be called countercultural movement there in Iran. You know, very interesting people, interesting filmmakers, great actors, poets, everything. Yeah, and they're up against a pretty strict censorship there. But they do make their films. And people like McMalbuff managed to make films that challenged the government's position on things pretty dead on. But his success as an artist and a commentator in his country, unbelievably enough, is respected. I mean, I think it could be pretty tense for him. But anyway, I correspond with people in Iran and in that part of the world.
Hal Hartley wrote and directed the new film No Such Thing. It opens in 6 cities this weekend: Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews 2 new Fox comedies, Andy Richter Controls the Universe and Greg the Bunny. This is Fresh Air. The Fox network has invested heavily in fantasy with its mid-season TV series. Tonight, Fox presents the 2nd installment of Andy Richter Controls the Universe, about an office worker with a very active imagination. Tomorrow night, Fox presents the premiere of Greg the Bunny, a new comedy mixing people and puppets in a very unusual way. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
These days on television, fantasy is becoming easier to come by than reality. Ally McBeal got a lot of notice for it 5 years ago, when the idea of seeing inside a person's head was still somewhat novel on television. Now, whether it's voiceover narration or flights of fancy, internal thoughts and external silliness are all over the place. When it becomes more common, it also becomes devalued. But these 2 new Fox comedies are worth sampling. Andy Richter Controls the Universe, starring Conan O'Brien's former sidekick, owes more to James Thurber than Ally McBeal. And Greg the Bunny is like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but with puppets instead of cartoons. The idea is that puppets, without being controlled by humans, coexist in the same universe. And that one of them, Greg the Bunny, talks his way into his big break as the new star of a children's TV show. Greg isn't that terrific a personality. He's no Alf, and though I know I'm dating myself here, he's no Bunny Rabbit from Captain Kangaroo. But it's a clever concept, and the human co-stars, Eugene Levy from Second City and American Pie, and Seth Green from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Austin Powers, make me laugh. Almost no one in primetime right now, though, is making me laugh as much as Andy Richter. It's very easy to make a bad show about a guy with an overactive imagination. If you remember the Hank Azaria show from a few months ago, and there's no real reason you should, you know that for a very painful fact. What's difficult is to make a good show about a guy who dreams too much. Andy Richter Controls the Universe does just that, and does it by succeeding in 2 different but equally important areas. First, the fantasies themselves, some visual, others verbal, are clever and unpredictable and often pile up like cars in a traffic jam. A single fantasy can go on for quite a while before reality intrudes again. As in this sequence, when Andy's colleagues from work drop by his apartment to ease the tension between Andy and a new employee named Byron.
The problem was, Byron was a good guy, and the four of us had a nice evening together.
Love is but a song we sing.
We played folk songs, wrestled.
You can make mountains ring.
Wrote letters for Amnesty International on behalf of political prisoners.
Come on, people now, smile on your brother.
And danced.
Try to love one another right now.
Then we all hugged each other goodbye. All right, none of this really happened. But we did have Chinese food, and we all liked Byron. And I felt awful.
The most impressive success of Andy Richter Controls the Universe, though, is that the scenes of Andy's reality are as good as the scenes in his head. The characters are strong. The cast members, including Irene Malloy from TV's Gross Point, are talented. And the plots, though not very complicated, are full of jokes and twists of their own. In this sluggish TV mid-season, it may sound like a fantasy, but these two shows, especially Andy Richter's, are worth checking out. Really.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Fresh Air and the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Avalon Travel Publishing, publisher of Moon Handbook's travel guides to Asia, the Pacific, and the Americas, on the web at moon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Jeffrey Goldberg discusses his New Yorker article about Saddam Hussein's chemical attack on the Kurds in 1988. And the implications for today. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.